We have been having some technical difficulties, which are now overcome. Jeff Sachs here, Masechet Ta'anit, Mishkan Sipora, Web Yeshiva, coming to you live from Efrat, on Daf Kof Dalet Omud Beis 24b. We are still in this long series of Agadot, still really playing off the energy of the story of Choni, the miracle workers, and when the miracles don't work. The Gemara says, Rava Ikla La Hagrunya. There are a number of names of towns, and if I was more oriented in that direction, I could have looked up, you know, where these towns are and what they are today. And there are people that are interested in such things. For the purposes of understanding the Gemara, it's not terribly important to know where they are, but there's a place called Hagrunya, and Rava went there. Gazar Ta'anita. And he decreed a fast because they were all in need of rain in that place. Velo Atamitra. This is the formula we've seen a number of times already. X came to Y, Vegazar Ta'anita, Velo Atamitra. And the rain did not arrive.
Rabbi Sachs.
It's just so Eulaic. Yes, who is that? Oh, Yehudi, how are you?
Okay, Baruch Hashem. I just said to my wife that basically I was thinking about this praying for rain, and it seemed to me that particular successful people who pray for rain, who actually get rain, are fall into the category of chasidim va'anshei ma'aseh. All these stories, the people who don't succeed are the people who are really gedolei hador or big shot chachamim.
That's interesting. Well, we're about to come up to Chanina Bardosa, who was called the last of the Anshei Maaseh.
Right.
Maybe we'll come back to your point if we get to him this evening, if not the next week. But there's something interesting to that. There's also a difference between the Chachamim, or the figures who are Gozer Ta'anita. They declare a fast. They say there's rain, but he should fast. And others who, you know, either roll up their sleeves and pray, or in the case of Choni, I mean, Choni does more than pray. You know, he kind of almost dares God not to send rain. It's kind of like a very assertive type of engagement with God. So Rava Iklila Argunia, Gazar Tanita Velo Atamitra. Omar Lohu, they say to him, right, because, you know, in other words, if you're supposed to be the rainmaker and you can't deliver, they have a taina. So he says to them, I guess the people in that place, Bitu kulo alma batani taichu lamachar. Amar lohu. He says to them, keep fasting. Meaning, I think Rashi explained that. In other words, don't break the fast between sunset and sunrise. And that's when normally when we have these fasts, it's just daytime fasting. So he says, keep it going, keep fasting. And the next day he says to them, Mi ika dechaze chelma. Chelma. He says, last night, did anybody have a dream? Tell me your dream. And the idea being that somehow the dream of the fasting people might, you know, contain some insight to what's going on. Omar Lohu, Rabbi Elazar Me Hagrunia. So Rabbi Elazar of this place says to him, he had a dream. And here's the dream. Lididi Akriun Bechelmi. In my dream, I saw the following. And I was told, Shlom Tav Larav Tav, Shalom Alechem, Larabi Larav Hatov. Merebon Tav, from the great master, meaning from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, de metuve metev la'amo, that is, does good for his people. So Shalom Aleichem to you, great rabbi from the great master in heaven who does good for his people. So Omar Rava says to this Rabbi Elazar, Shma mino et ratzoni miboy rachame. Your dream is a sign that this is indeed a propitious moment. We should pray. Boy Rachme Vati Mitra. So they pray and the rain comes. So here it wasn't the fast that did it, apparently. It was the prayer that had the good effect. Hahi Gavra, so the Gemara tells another story about a certain person. Hahi Gavra, it chayev nagda, bevedina. There was a certain person who was chayev malkot. They were going to whip him in the betin of Rava. Mishum debal nochrit. And his offense was that he had relations with a non-Jewish woman. So Nagde, and this is a rabbinic flogging. This is the type of makot that the chachamim can decree on someone for a variety of improper behaviors. Nagde Rava umet. So they administer the lashes, and unfortunately the fellow wasn't up to it, and he died. This was not a death sentence. But the lighter sentence of some flogging, he must have had a weak heart or something. The ticker gave out and he died, which, you know, is unfortunate. Well, so this is unfortunate for a whole variety of reasons.
Aren't you supposed to test the person before you flog them, according to my Masechet Makot, and make certain?
Yes, but you know, aren't you a physician, Yehudi?
Yes, I'm a retired one right now, but go for it.
So, you know, I mean, you know that, like, before a person goes in, even for a minor surgery, right, they do all types of tests, right? They take blood pressure, and they do blood work, and they take a chest x-ray. And also, sometimes a patient going in for a simple routine procedure drops dead on the table. I mean, that seems to be with the case here.
Yeah, but that usually leads to a lawsuit. I guess that's what's happening right now.
And that's exactly what happens here. But it's not the kind of lawsuit that your malpractice insurance is going to help you out with.
Gotcha.
But we all know. I mean, presumably they did this in the Bet Din. They did. They only administer the lashes if they know the person is up. They're not going to take like an Alta Kaka who, you know, you look at him crooked, he's going to fall over and crack, right? Because in the time of Rava, you know that the idea of the death penalty, like a whole variety of other things that are sanctioned in the Torah, but that in reality were not practiced, or at least hardly ever practiced. And the death penalty being one of them. You know, if you read the Chumash, you think they're giving the death penalty every Sheni V'Chamishi. But in reality, there were so many mitigating circumstances, and the bar was set so high to administer the death penalty that in reality it almost never happened, or after a certain point it actually never happened. This is of course similar to the cases of the Ben Sorer Umore or the Ir Hanidachat, which the Torah presents as an actual factual halachic reality, but the Gemara is so disturbed by these problems, by these circumstances, that it creates a circumstance that in which it's actually, you know, it's a good kind of compromise. We don't have like amendments to the Torah, but we have ways of taking ideas and sidelining them so that they're technically still on the books. I mean, nobody would say that the halacha changed. You know, we have an allergy to saying the halacha changed. The death penalty is on the books. It's just been made operatively non-existent, or so exceedingly rare that it practically doesn't exist. That would be a good, I mean, without giving away my own political views, which, as you know, are perfectly centrist. Everybody's views are perfectly centrist to them. The person slightly to the right of you is a fanatic. And the person slightly to the left of you is a bleeding heart liberal. But my own views on the Second Amendment in America, not just after these tragedies, these horrors of the last couple of weeks, is that you should find a way to say, okay, the Constitution allows for the right to bear arms, but we should figure out a way where in reality it's not operative, like the death penalty is in halacha. It still exists, but in reality, we don't do it.
The case. Did not allow corporal punishment at that time, but the Babylonians did. I mean, at the hands of the rabbis.
No, so well, we're going to get. You're anticipating the next line in the Gemara.
Okay, fine.
So, Shalom.
There are things that are similar to amendments. They have takanot. For instance, you know, the Torah says you should blow the shofar, and the Chavon Kham say not to do it on Shabbat. So there are, you can call that like a type of amendment to the rules.
Kind of. It's an easier to have a shev al taseh than to allow something which is forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
Right? In other words, that was a sidetrack. But the point is that Yehudi might be right, that they should have figured out a way that of anticipating that the guy was going to die, they shouldn't have given him makot. Maybe they did, but becholzot, like the example I gave of routine surgical procedures, sometimes tragedies happen on the operating table. Uvda, the guy died. And what was the problem? There was a lawsuit, but not the kind of lawsuit you were thinking of, Yehudi. What happened? Ishtoma milta bei shavur malka. Melech Shapur was a 4th century Babylonian king.
Shapur II.
He was in charge of what?
Shapur II. Shapur I ruled at the time of Rav and Shmuel.
Yes, but I knew him well, so I just call him Shapur. I don't need the fancy numbers. Like I call her Queen Elizabeth. I don't have to say Queen Elizabeth II. Everybody knows I'm talking about the current reigning monarch. Long may she reign well past her platinum jubilee. King, yes, correct. King Shapur II of the 4th century Bovel. So in other words, the point is that the Gentile authorities heard that the Jews had carried out the death penalty, which they were not allowed to do. Now, al pi halacha, they weren't allowed to do it either, because the death penalty is only something that could be carried out by the Sanhedrin in Eretz Yisrael. Right? So, like a rumor got around. It was a false rumor, because they didn't do a death penalty. They were doing some other procedure, and the man died. But if you're whipping someone and he dies, it kind of sounds like you whipped him to death. Like, you can understand how such a rumor would have gotten to the Gentile authorities. Right, it's not such a stretch to say the Jewish court whipped a man to death, because that's what happened. They didn't whip him to death; they whipped him, comma, and he accidentally died. The Jews, although they had certain authority, Rava had authority over Jewish affairs. There was a kind of Jewish self-government. But the Jewish people did not have the authority to carry out the death penalty. That was a right that was reserved only to the Gentile host society. So the problem isn't so much that an innocent man was killed. I mean, or a man who wasn't deserving of the death penalty was killed. The problem was that the Jews were carrying out or appeared to be carrying out the death sentence.
Didn't Rava ask the Reish Galuta for permission to do this? Was the power actually in the hand of
not to execute the fellow? Right. In other words, the Bet Din, the Jewish Batei Din, Bavel, operated with the sanction for certain purposes, with the sanction of the Babylonian authority. But this did not allow them to. This did not allow them to.
But wasn't the power actually in the
hands
of the Rosh Galuta, the Reish Kabbata? No, it was the people who were the yeshiva heads would recommend to the Reish Galuta to do something like corporal punishment. I don't think they were the ones.
But then it was carried out. But then it was carried out by the Babylonian authorities. That, by the way, that was true in Galuyot throughout history. That was true in Poland as well. The Vad Arba Artsot would have influence on the Polish court, and they would be able to recommend also that certain Jews would be taken care of.
Are you sure that
but,
love was done by the Babylonian government and not by the racial government? Are you certain that in the time of the Bible, if corporal punishment was administered, it was done by the Persians and not by the Reish-Galutas people? Because the Reish-Galutas seems to have had quite a Guryonim at his disposal, you know, who basically were working.
But they weren't doing capital punishment. They weren't executing people.
No, I'm
people.
Talking Malko now. I'm saying. But
yes, they were doing Yehudi, listen, please, I'm begging you. Please just listen. We're talking about lashing. We're not talking about the death penalty. They were doing lashes, not to kill the guy, but just to give him lashes. And they were doing it, the Jews were doing it to another Jew in the Jewish court with the permission of the Babylonian authorities. But the guy died, and it appeared as if they had carried out a death sentence. And that was the problem, because that was what they were not allowed to do. So Ishtami Milta Bey Shavur Malka, the royal court hears this, and they're going to make trouble for Rava because he's overstepped his bounds, he's overstepped his authority. Omra Le, Ifra Hurmiz, his mother, the queen mother, her name was Ifra Hurmiz. Maybe she was Ifra Hurmiz the third or the fourth, I'm not sure. But we used to just call the queen mom Elizabeth. Her name was also Elizabeth, even though there had been an Elizabeth before her. But you know who I'm talking about. This is the mother, the royal mother of Shavur the second in the early 4th century CE. So Ima de Shavur Malka, the mother of the king, says to him, Lo lihave loch esek dvarim bahada yudai. Don't get involved with these Jews. The chol man de boin mimaraihu. Yehovlehu, whatever they ask from their master, meaning from God in heaven, he gives to them. There are a number of kids. This mother of Shavur appears a number of times in the Gemara, and it seems she had, I don't know what to say exactly. She had some kind of sympathy for the Jews.
Thanks.
And she says to her son, who's about to start causing trouble for Rava, don't make trouble for him. Because those Jews, they have an in with their God. And, you know, he'll put the pulse of the nur on you, he'll put the curse on you, he'll come out on top. Don't get involved with these guys. I always imagine her being one of the Macbeth witches or something. I'm not sure. Omar Law, he says to his mother, Mayi, what are you talking about? So she says, listen, how do I know that these people have an in with their God? Because, for example, when they pray, it rains. Now, this is how the story connects. How do I know that they have special powers? Because whenever there's a drought, they pray and it rains. Which, by the way, is beneficial to the Bavlim as well as to the. It doesn't just rain on the Jewish fields; it rains also on the Bavli fields. So it's good for everyone. Omar La, he says to her, "Hahu mishum de zimna de mitrahu." Oh. You know the logical error that, you know, like in Latin, there are different names for all different types of logical errors. Like if you studied logic in college, you had to learn all these Latin names for these different, you know, like logic is like mathematics. Like when you study logic, it's flow charted out on the board like a mathematical equation. And there are different Latin names for different logical steps in a logical proof. So one of them is post hoc ergo propter hoc. After this, therefore, because of this. It's a kind of very common logical mistake we all make. And the classic example of that is, I went out in the morning and everyone was carrying an umbrella. And then it started raining. You see from this that carrying an umbrella is a skula to make it rain. Right? The idea that carrying the umbrella in the morning is what causes it to rain later in the afternoon. No. It was raining because that's what meteorologically was going to happen. People had access to the weather report. They were smart enough to bring an umbrella in anticipation of the rain. But it's not the cause of the rain. Right? Post hoc ergo propto hoc. Shavuor says to his mother, you're making the same mistake. You think the Jews daven and that's what brings the rain. No, the Jews daven in advance of when it's supposed to rain. And then it rains. They're not causing it to rain. Which is, by the way, a good question. Everyone is waiting around for the rain. You know, there's a drought. You know, the rain doesn't come on time. So you pray, you fast, you pray a little more, you fast a little more. You gather everyone together for an assembly in the town square if enough time hasn't passed. You bring out the Sefer Torah. You put an afar on top of the Torah, on the head of the Nasi, all the things we learned about in the Mishnah, and then it rains. So, I mean, the one thing that we know is that sooner or later it rains. So we ascribe it to our righteousness. But Shavuor is a skeptic. He says, how do you know it was their prayer that brought the rain? Maybe it was going to rain with or without their prayer. Ahu mishum dizimna dimitrihu. Ela laboy rachame ha'idna. Let's put them to the test. Tell them to daven for rain now. It happens to be the middle of the dry season in the summer when it's not supposed to rain. It's Kufat Tammuz. Velete Mitra. In the middle of Tammuz, in the middle of July, let them pray. Let's see if rain comes now. Because right? it never rains in Bavel in that time of year. Right? In other words, it's like here in Israel in August. Do you have to look at the weather? You only have to look at the weather to know how hot it's going to be. Is it going to be hot or hot? Right? But what's the weather? The weather is Cham V'Yavesh, warm and dry. And tomorrow, you know what it's going to be on the second day of August? Cham V'Yavesh. It's only a question of how cham it's going to be. So you don't need to be a Navi or have any special powers in order to say the weather report for the first week in August. It's just a question of how many degrees of cham it's going to be. So he says, if they really have this power, let them daven in July for rain. And let's see if something comes. But in January, February, that's no sign of their great powers. V'shalcha lel Rava. So the mother tells Rava, this is what you got to do. You got to pray. Kivein datcha, have kavona, she tells him. Have good kavona. Uvoi rachame, and pray for rain. Delete mitra, boy rachame. Below Atamitra, and the rain didn't come. So the king's suspicion was correct. You can pray all you want. You can have all the kavana you want in July for rain. It's not going to come. So Amar Lefanov. So Rava says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono Shel Olam, Elokim Ba'ozneinu Shamanu. This is a posuk in Tehillim. Elokim Ba'ozneinu Shamanu. We heard with our own ears. Avotenu Siprulanu. Our forefathers have told us. Po'alta Bimehen. You did great deeds in their days. Bimekedem, in the days of old. Va'anu Ba'enenu Loraenu. But we haven't seen any great miracles in our day. Right? Maybe we're overdue for a miracle. That's the way it is with miracles. Miracles often happened to people that came before you. And everybody who could use a miracle in their own day, you have to work for it. Lo ra'inu. Ata mitra. And so what happens? It starts to rain, even in July. Ad deshfuch marzevei. You have to read this according to the girsa in the, not the girsa in the Gemara that says tzipori. In many Gemaras it says Tzipori, and then Mesoros Hashas corrects it to Mechoza. Tzipori is, of course, in Eretz Yisrael. But Mechoza in Bavel, until all of the, what do you call those things? The sewers, the, no, not the sewers. You know, the things that collect the rain. The drains. No. No, what do you call
them? Gutters.
The gutters on the roofs until the marzev fills up, right? Now there's the rain is pouring off the roofs of the houses. And are flowing into the diglat, into the Tigris River, meaning there's so much rain coming out the place is flooding. Ata abua it chazi le bechelma. So Rava's father shows up to him in a dream. Va'amar le mi ika de mitrach kame shemaya kule hai. You had to trouble heaven so much. Don't be a show off, right? In other words, such a miracle, like a little bit of rain would have also done the trick, but you had to cause like a torrential downpour in the middle of the summer. Omar lay, and the father says to him, still in the same dream, Shane duchtich, Shane mikomcha, change your place. Which he takes to understand that, Rashi explains, takes to understand that he shouldn't sleep in that same bed the next night. You know, like we have an idea like Meshane Mokom, Meshane Mazel. If you change your place, you change your place, you change your luck. So he tells him, don't sleep in this bed tomorrow night. And what happens the next night? Lamachar Ashgeche. Demarsham purye basakine. I mean, I guess it means like bandits came in or hitmen came in. And, you know, like, I mean, this is like you see it in movies. He's not sleeping in his own bed, but in his bed are the bed sheets and the pillows and whatnot. It looks like there's a body there. And they start stabbing it with the swords. And instead of hearing screams, what is it? It's, you know, like the down blanket. It's the pillow. All the feathers are going because, in other words, either this is disconnected, either the father was just giving him in the dream some good advice to tell him that something bad is going to happen, bandits are going to break into the house tomorrow night, you don't want to be caught in your bed. Or maybe there was something going on here. In other words, who might have wanted to do bad to Rava? What do you think?
Well, anyone whose crops were ruined because of rain in the summer.
Oh, people whose crops were ruined because of rain in the summer. Or?
Well, there was obviously somebody on the king's side who was not too favorable to the Jews either. So
the king isn't so happy that he was shown up by this Rava. Or there's a third person that might have a gripe against Rava. The fellow who was wrongfully put to death in the beginning of the story, right? Yes. So he's somebody who, I mean, he's already fallen in with a bad crowd because he's having relations with non-Jewish women, right? And although he deserved to be whipped, he didn't deserve to be killed. So you can understand that maybe there's somebody there. So maybe, in other words, maybe the story is connected to other things, or maybe it was just advice that the father was giving him from beyond the grave.
Isn't it
Rav Papa? You see where we are.
Isn't it possible that his father's just giving him the business because basically what Rav was doing was acting like if he's Shmuel Anavi, he's not Shmuel Anavi, you know. I mean, he has no business doing something like that. Really, in other words, even if
that's the first part. That's the first part of what the father says to him. But the question is, what's the connection to the second thing he says to him about you better not sleep in his bed tomorrow night?
Well, it could be that it was heaven that got mad at Rava for doing this and put the knives there. In other words, I don't have to feel. Remember,
there's a possibility
where heaven does all kinds of things that heaven doesn't normally do, because all these various people have some kind of a direct connection, or at least they're trying to demonstrate that they have one. So every so often, Hashem gets a little annoyed, like he did with Eliyahu, you know, and sends them a message that they really should cut the sounds, you know. What's he doing, a demonstration for the guy?
Yeah, could be. Although, in other words, it's not just a demonstration for the goyim. The queen mother tells him, you better prove that you have a special connection to heaven. Because otherwise, you're in real trouble for this mishap that took place in your court. In other words, it's a complicated, you know, kind of circumstance of the political situation, the halachic situation, the power dynamics. He's really in a very difficult circumstance here. He's in a very difficult circumstance here. Okay, the next part of the Gemara goes on. Rav Papa Gazar Ta'anita Velo Ata Mitra. Rav Papa declares a fast in a certain place, but rain doesn't come. Chalash Libe is part, you know, there's two different types of chalashut. There's chalash da'ate, which is a kind of like anguish. And there's chalash libe, which is a kind of, usually like a kind of like physical weakness. In other words, he's fasting. He declared a fast, but it was hard for him to fast. Right? You know about such things. Right? We've all had that. You know, late on a hot afternoon of a fast day, chalash libe no. Right? Sometimes you have to go take a nap. So what does he do? Seraf pincha de daisa. So he eats something. You know, like if you're really not feeling well on a fast day, not Yom Kippur, but on a regular fast day or on one of these fast days for rain, you know, if you're really not feeling well, so you can eat. So he gave himself a heter to eat a bowl of daisa, a bowl of oatmeal. Uvo'e rachame. And then he davened. Meaning he was re-energized by having eaten on the fast day. And with that energy, he put it to good use. He davened. The lo atamitra. And the rain still didn't come. Omar le Rav Nachman bar Ushpasti. I saref mar pincha achrita de daisa otimitra. Oh, maybe what you need is a second bowl of oatmeal. But maybe if you eat more, you'll have even more strength. Maybe if you'll break the fast more, you'll have even more strength, and then you'll daven even better. Which might be, I think some might read that as like sarcasm, right? In other words, he was saying, you know, you broke the fast, and you're expecting miracles. Maybe you should eat a little more. Ichsif v'chalish date. So he was ashamed and he became weak-minded. He was emotionally suffering. He got upset. Va'ata mitra. And then the rain came. So ultimately, the rain comes not as a function of fasting and not as a function of prayer, but as a function of being, I don't know, what would you say?
Well, what's
is a function of an emotional state.
Is there a difference between chalash date and chalash libe in a sense? Because that the first one.
Well, I said earlier. I said a minute ago. Chalash libe usually means like he became physically weak. He became physically weak through the fast, and that's why he ate. He broke his fast. Chalash date is more of a kind of mental or emotional state. And because he was upset. Then because he's upset, then the rain comes. So in other words, like I said,
I'm sorry. Isn't there in these stories a certain feeling of, you know, presumably when we decree a fast, what we're doing is the whole community should pray, and the zechut, whatever tshuva they did and their prayers that they've done, and the fasting that they're doing, HaKadosh Baruch Hu should have rachamim on them, and it should rain. Now, that is what this Masechet is teaching, okay? Mm-hmm. You have, I'm getting the feeling that these stories are somehow trying to back up the fact that every so often Chassidim and Shem Maaseh on the level of Pony and Chanina Vendosa are able to bring the rain even when everybody else has, the community has failed. But, you know, the zechut of somebody, there's no zechut in Chalash Data. It sounds like he's embarrassed. It sounds like he doesn't, he's going to.
It doesn't sound like
he's going to face the public tomorrow.
It says explicitly that he's embarrassed.
I think that he showed remorse the second time, and that's why the rain came. He felt remorse on eating the daisa.
Oh. Even though he ate the daisa.
It means his face turned white.
But why, Bracha, why do you think he feels remorse for eating the daisa?
Because after he ate the daisa, he nothing happened, right? It wasn't.
Yeah.
And so he felt remorse when he started to pray again. He felt a little bit bad about having eaten the daisa, and then the rain came.
Well, he feels bad about having eaten the daisa, or he feels bad about what this Rav Nachman says to him?
Both. I'm sorry.
Both, I think.
Shachestein understands this, that Rav Nachman ridiculed him for breaking it before praying for rain. Rashi is explained by Marsha, by causing Rav Papa to feel the severity of his humiliation, he hoped that God would show him the favor and compensate him. I mean, the word ichsiv certainly means embarrassed. There's no way we can say it means anything else.
Right. No. Right. So he's even though presumably he had permission to eat because of his physical condition, nevertheless, it's still, you know, an embarrassing type of thing. In other words, there are people who all types of people who don't fast on a fast day. God knows. But you know, like if you eat on a fast day because of a medical condition, because you're pregnant or you have to take medications, whatever it is, so you should do it in a kind of a tsanua way, right? Thank God, I don't think I've ever had to eat on a fast day, Baruch Hashem. But if I did, I would do it, you know, with a little bit of tsniut. I would do it in private. I wouldn't flaunt it, you know. So here, in other words, I don't think that he was flaunting it, but Rav Nachman seems to know that he had eaten the bowl of daisa. And that's the thorn in the comment, I guess. He says, well, maybe you didn't eat enough. But say avon. Hearty appetite, go at it. Why? Maybe you should have like a Dagwood Bumstead sandwich instead. So the point is that of all the things that are meant to bring the rain, the fasting, the prayer, the what does it is this chalash date, you know, kind of like the humility that's brought about from suffering the embarrassment. You know, it's kind of because like
he was the one who declared the fast, so that's why.
Right. But it's like what they talk about, like the Navardic school of Musser. You know, like in Navardic, they would teach people to suffer embarrassment. You know, like they would tell the boys in the yeshiva, go into the hardware store, wait online. When you get up to the clerk, order a pound of Swiss cheese. The clerk is going to berate you and say, what kind of idiot are you? Don't you know we don't sell Swiss cheese in a hardware store? And everyone will laugh at you and you'll be embarrassed. And it's good a little bit to suffer embarrassment. It makes you humble. Now, there were other schools of Musser. And then there were, of course, other orientations that were against the whole Musser movement to begin with. But that idea that a little bit of embarrassment can create a humility, can create a chalisha tadat, an emotional state, well, that seems to be what's happened here. That seems to be what's happened here. And the fact is, the rain comes. Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. Now we get into Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. We will not tonight finish the stories of Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. But let's just say something first about Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa. The Mishnah in Avos says, hold on a second, where's my, here. Sorry, I don't have it on the screen, but the Mishnah in Avos, Perek Gimel, what is it? Sorry, Perek Gimel. The Mishnah in Avos says the following: Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa Omer, Kol sheyirat chet'o hodemet lachochmato, chachmato mitkayemet. Anyone whose fear of sin precedes his wisdom will be preserved. In the scale of religious virtue, having yirat shamayim, having fear of heaven, fear of sin, if that's the base on which your spiritual pyramid stands, and you add wisdom to that, that's a good basis. That's a good foundation for your wisdom. You know, wisdom is a kind of funny thing. Use it or lose it. The Chazal never thought that wisdom was a kind of like bank account that, you know, you whatever you put in stays there and gains interest. It has to do with on what basis the wisdom is founded, whether or not it will be preserved, whether or not it will increase, whether or not it will turn out to be, profitable. But if your wisdom, if your knowledge precedes your piety, so then that's not necessarily a recipe for the wisdom to be preserved. And as it, he kind of confronts these two different spiritual virtues, wisdom, knowledge, and piety. And it says piety is the first virtue. Right? What do we say? Reshit chokhma. Fill in the blank. Reshit chokhma. Yirat Elokim. The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. That is, if your study comes from a place of piety, it's going to be transformatively different than if it's a kind of, you know, cold, intellectual or academic pursuit. Huaya Omer, and Rabbi Chanina ben Dosa would say, Kol shemasav mirubin mechokhmato, anyone whose deeds, we said earlier, Yehudi pointed out that Chanina ben Dosa is called one of the anshei ma'aseh, the men of good deed, the men of religious action. So anyone whose actions are greater than his wisdom, chokhmato kayemet. Kol shechokhmato mirubin mechokhmato. But if your wisdom doesn't translate into action, ein chachmato mitkayemet, right? Then your wisdom will not be preserved. I mean, like on a simplest level, this relates to the machloket Masechet Kedushin about midrash and maaseh, about limud and maaseh, right? Which takes precedent? To study about something or to do it? Like, what's better, to learn Masechet Sukkah or to shake a lulav and sit in the sukkah? So in the end, the Gemara gives a very typically Jewish response. The answer, of course, is both. Because limud takes precedent, hamevi ledei maaseh. That limud is more significant because you learn and learning leads to action. Although we know that this is not always the case. Could you imagine someone who would want to study and not put that study into action? Well, there are such people. There are, and they're not just the maskilim of old. Right? There are such people. But years ago when I ran a fellowship for young educators, we had an opportunity to bring together young Dati educators with people from what was the Alma Beit Midrash. You know, there's this secular Beit Midrash in Tel Aviv of people. They were really among the first to, you know, with this kind of return to the Jewish learning in our generation, without necessarily putting it as a part of return to Jewish observance. And now we have these other institutions all around the country that are doing similar things. Anyway, it was this interesting, you know, encounter between, you know, religious educators and secular people, you know, all of whom are in different ways engaged in study of Torah. And we studied together the sugyas about Netilat Yadayim in Masechet Chulin. Sugyas that I think we learned together many years ago, those of you that were part of the shiur way back when in the caravan. And these people were very energized and invested in their learning. And I remember one of our teachers asked them, do you wash Netilat Yadayim before you eat bread? And the person said, no, never. And the religious educators couldn't get their heads around the idea that people would spend time and energy and effort into studying the sugyas and the Gemara and not automatically want to put it into action. It's lahavdil, it's like, you know, the mystery that so many religious people had about those actors in Shtisel, right? You know, who so convincingly portrayed the Haredi world, and even doing so in Yiddish, but in their own lives, they're all completely secular. I mean, I know people that don't believe it, can't believe that these actors and actresses are not actually frum. They don't actually, or that at least they weren't Chozer Betshuva, you know, having performed these characters on the small screen. But in fact, that's the reality. So one wonders about like the long range Chachmatam Mitkayemet or not. That would be an interesting test case. But that's Rabbi Chanina Bardossa, this figure who says Yir'ah and Ma'aseh are the foundations, right? Piety in action, piety in character are the foundations for wisdom. And now we're going to see a series of agadot about Chanina's miracle works, but we're going to have to cut it here and we'll come back to it next week. So in the meantime, I wish you Chag Matan Torateinu Sameach.
Chag
Shavuot on Motzei Shabbat and on Sunday and Monday for some of you. And enjoy your cheesecake. And we will meet again next Tuesday. Those of you in the neighborhood, I will be teaching in Mishkan Sipora at 4 a.m., which is either very late or very early, depending upon your point of view. We'll be looking at an interesting question of how Bate Din can and should calculate the value of calculate sentimental value when making assessments of Dine Nezikin. In other words, if I take a $100 bill of yours and I rip it up, I owe you $100. It's very easy to assess the loss that you suffered. But what if I take a watch that has absolutely no market value because it's not a valuable watch, the watch doesn't work, it can't be repaired, you couldn't sell it for a nickel on eBay, but it belonged to your great-great-grandfather and has a lot of sentimental value to you. How would a betin evaluate that cost for damages? Okay, so Chag Sameach, and we'll continue next week.
Thank you very much. Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. Thank you.